طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Before we get into our forum on Gaza this morning, I want to let you know about an important event coming up on March 22nd, World Water Day. The Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine is marking the day with a special virtual celebration. They are calling Water, Health, and Human Rights, marking World Water Day from the U.S. to Palestine. The keynote speaker is Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, who sponsored in Congress the Emergency Water is a Human Right Act. Other presenters include Monica Lewis Patrick from We the People of Detroit, Matoi Monroe from the United American Indians of New England, Nadal Al-Azraq, Executive Director of the One for Three organization, and Jihad Abu Salim from the American Friends Service Committee. Check out the Alliance website for details on how to register for the World Water Day webinar. Check it at AllianceForWaterJusticeInPalestine.org, all one word, AllianceForWaterJusticeInPalestine.org. Moving on. Today we focus on Gaza through a webinar sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. In this forum, we will examine the situation in the Gaza Strip, including how the Gaza Strip has been isolated from the West Bank and besieged by Israel, the role of Hamas and related Palestinian political dynamics, and the humanitarian situation in light of repeated Israeli military campaigns. More than a decade of blockade, and now COVID-19. Our panel includes Jihad Abu Salim from Gaza. He is the Palestine Activism Education and Policy Association at the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. Tanya Hari, who is the Executive Director of GISHA, the Legal Center for Freedom of Movement, whose goal is to protect the freedom of movement of Palestinians, especially Gaza residents. And Omar Shaban. Omar Shaban is the founder and director of the Gaza-based PALTHINK for Strategic Studies, an independent think tank with no political affiliation. The panel is moderated by Khaled El-Gindi, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, where he also directs the program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian affairs, and Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. We jump right into this edited version of the forum with an introduction and first question by Khaled El-Gindi.
So today, we're talking about the Gaza Strip. Since 2007, Gaza has been subjected to an Israeli-imposed blockade, as well as repeated military offensives by Israel, both of which have devastated Gaza's fragile economy and civilian infrastructure. The blockade has also been supported by neighboring Egypt to the south, and more or less acquiesced in by the international community for the last 14 or so years. As a result, Gaza and its 2 million Palestinians have long been treated as though they were somehow outside of the political process, what we used to call the peace process, and in some ways treated as though it were a separate conflict from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict itself. Before we get into these issues, I thought we might start with you, Jihad, just to give us a little bit of background on Gaza. So I'd like to ask you maybe to help set the scene for us. Give us some historical and demographic background on Gaza, how Gaza came into being as an entity, the nature of its population, and how it came to be isolated from the West Bank.
So the region known today as the Gaza Strip came into being as a direct result of the Arab-Israeli War of 1948, which led to the establishment of the State of Israel and the destruction of Palestinian society as it existed before 1948. Prior to the war, Palestine was divided into administrative districts that made economic and geographic sense. Each of the major districts consisted of one or more major cities and dozens of villages. One of those districts was the Gaza district, which included two sub-districts, Gaza, the Gaza sub-district, and the Be'er Saba or Be'er Sheva sub-district. And the Gaza district consisted of more than 50% of the total area of historic or mandatory Palestine. And at the heart of that district, Gaza City was the political, economic, and cultural center of that region. And it was surrounded by dozens of villages that, although those villages maintained their local unique customs and traditions, for them, Gaza City was like a state capital, an economic center and market where they exchange goods and services. Gaza City was home to schools, was home to the Gaza College, which was founded in 1942 by Wadia Tarazi, who was a graduate of Haverford College in Pennsylvania. And Gaza City also had a train station that connected the district with cities like Haifa or Jerusalem. And people could even make it to the eastern bank of the Suez Canal in the matter of hours. So again, Gaza was the capital of that district. During the 1948 war, Zionist militias that would later form the core of the Israeli military expanded the boundaries allocated to the Jewish state according to the 1947 partition plan, and of course conquered almost 78% of mandatory Palestine. And during the war, Palestinians from almost the majority of parts of Palestine were expelled by Israeli forces or just escaped the fighting in search for security and temporary refuge. And for thousands of Palestinians, Gaza City and the villages and towns south to the city became a safe haven for tens of thousands of refugees, as these territories were beyond the reach of Israeli forces. As the war came to an end, the Gaza sub-district was reduced from an area of 430 square miles to a strip of land, and hence the term Gaza Strip, a strip of land of only 138 square miles. The strip, the Gaza Strip, which was already home to 100,000 Palestinians before 1948, would become also home to for an additional number of 200,000 refugees who were expelled from more than 50 towns and villages in the surrounding area, and more villages and cities in the larger Palestine area. In 1948, refugee camps were established, and the organization I work with, AFSC, was mandated by the United Nations to set up the refugee camp system in Gaza that would later be passed to UNRWA. So for Palestinians in Gaza and elsewhere, that refugee experience, which started in 1948, was thought of as a temporary experience. People thought, expected that they would be able to return to their towns, cities, properties, harvest, fields, and so on and so forth, from which they were forced to leave during the course of fighting. Israel, of course, refused to allow the refugees to return. And this is how the Palestinian refugee question was born. Gaza here represents a unique case because, unlike the West Bank, a smaller geographic entity emerged as a result of the war, known as the Gaza Strip, but it hosted a large population compared to the geographic area it inhabits. And that geographic area did not have enough resources to provide for this population. And this is how, you know, fast forward to today, this is how the Gaza Strip ends up today with more than 2 million Palestinians trapped in this very small territory, 70% of whom come from towns and villages that are just within walking distance from the fence separating the Gaza Strip from what is today the state of Israel. And the Gaza Strip, just to give some numbers, the Gaza Strip has one of the highest population densities in the world. We're talking about an average of 13,000 persons per 1 square mile. And this is, of course, you know, the situation is way harsher in refugee camps, where, for example, in an area like Al-Shata refugee camp, which is an area of which has an area of 0.2 square miles, that's 51 hectares. And just to give like a sense of comparison, the total area of the Mall of America is just 40 hectares. So the Ashata refugee camp is just 10 square miles, is just 10 hectares shy of Ashata refugee camp. That camp is almost home to 100,000 people living there. So when we talk about the population density, and things like that. So the population density is expected to double in 30 years. And this is how the Gaza Strip came into being. It was, as a geographic entity, it came into being as a result of man-made conditions, mainly the war of 1948 and the establishment of Israel.
Thank you so much, Ihad. That was tremendous summary of the background. Tanya, I want to move a little more into the current day. Let's go back a little bit. You know, for many years, people talked about, you know, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip together, right? They were both occupied territories. There were settlements in both. In 2005, Israel moved its settlements out of Gaza, removed them under the disengagement plan of Ariel Sharon. And then in 2007, Gaza came under the control of Hamas following elections. Because of these two developments, a lot of people, a lot of Israelis, a lot of Americans, I think people hear this in Congress a lot, have come to talk about Gaza as a completely independent entity, as Khaled alluded to, and no longer legally occupied, arguing that Israel is gone, it doesn't have legal obligations, it's not occupied territory, it's almost like it's an independent state. So can you talk about the situation in Gaza from that perspective? Legally, is Gaza still occupied? And if yes, why? And with those two developments I described, the end of settlements and the beginning of the blockade with Hamas, what aspects of Israeli policy have changed towards Gaza, particularly in terms of treating Gaza now as a hostile entity and all that that entails, and then the blockade, which has been going on now for more than a decade?
So I think we should start with, you know, maybe busting the biggest myth that certainly exists in Israel and probably also among audiences in the U.S., and that's that Israel left the Gaza Strip. And Gisha was actually founded in 2005 the same year as the disengagement, to look at what would happen in Gaza after the disengagement. And there was a really already a need for an organization like ours in 2005, before Hamas came to power in 2007, because movement and access restrictions were a facet of daily life, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. So it's a kind of misnomer to think that movement restrictions started just when Hamas came to power. They were certainly in place for decades before then. And my colleagues can certainly share a personal perspective about that. What we note about what happened at the time of the disengagement was that Israel didn't leave. It simply retreated to the perimeter. It remained in the air. It remained at sea. It remained in a strip of land inside of the Gaza Strip that it refers to as the buffer zone. It takes liberties to enter that area at will. Last year, it entered about once per week to level lands and to conduct operations in those areas. It sprays herbicides from the air in order to kill weeds and vegetation in that area. It controls the population registry, the majority of fuel and electricity entering the strip. And of course, the bread and butter of my day-to-day life, movement of people and movement of goods. So I say all of that because I think that, you know, whether you're a legal expert or not, you can agree with me that control should translate into some element of responsibility. In international law, our analysis is that the test of effective control still determines that Gaza is occupied. And we don't see occupation as a black and white question. We see it on a scale. It's a kind of shades of gray. So the situation in the strip may look slightly different than it does in the West Bank, but that doesn't mean that Gaza is not occupied. And the fact that it is occupied means that Israel continues to owe certain obligations. Now, when Hamas took over in 2007, Israel simply used the control it already had over Gaza to enact what it called economic warfare, to close the Gaza Strip, to limit access and movement through its borders. The idea really was to put pressure on the Hamas regime and on the civilian population. So another, I think, big myth and misunderstanding about the situation is that Israel is only restricting for security reasons, and that couldn't be further from the truth. From day one, there were political goals, and they continue to this day. I also would want to just note that I'll be using the word closure, not blockade. Now, a blockade in international law denotes a kind of goal that Israel might have. And unfortunately, I've never heard really the goal of what Israel is doing in Gaza. There's no real end game that we can say when that goal is achieved, the blockade will end. And so we use closure again to denote that Israel already had control. Now, over time, and because of pressure, certain things have changed. I would also really like to emphasize that many security officials within Israel noted that the closure of Gaza, as it was being enforced after 2007, was leading to a situation of pretty extreme desperation, lack of hope among many of Gaza's young people. And they said this is actually a security threat for Israel. So what some may have seen as an opportunity or a means of putting pressure on the strip, many other security officials said, hold on, don't go too far. Unfortunately, today, some elements of policy have changed, but not enough to transform the situation. Israeli officials, they see Gaza as a kind of crisis to be managed, not one to be solved. We can get into that a bit more later. I think that the important thing to keep in mind, like I said, is that this myth that everything that's happening in Gaza is related to security couldn't be further from the truth.
Thanks, Tanya. Omar, if you could sort of paint a picture for us from the perspective of someone in Gaza, what does the closure or blockade look like from the inside? How does it affect daily life? What are the kinds of things that are restricted, in terms of goods that can come in or out? This idea that Tanya noted about the absence of any clear end game. Could you pick up on that? And also as a, as an analyst, tell us what your understanding of the political goals of this Israeli closure or blockade are. What is the expectation that somehow Hamas will give up its arms, or you know, what is the political goal behind this, if in fact there is one?
So thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's my pleasure. I think there were so many reports about Gaza, but I will try to make on the more strategic thing. Gaza has pushed the siege, the Israeli siege in Gaza has pushed Gaza back around by 30 years backward. Gaza is much poorer than before. Gaza used to be a very mosaic, dynamic, diversified society. So many Israelis were coming to Gaza, staying over for 2 to 3 days. Gaza was a place for tourism from everywhere, like Greece, like Cyprus. We have a diversified society. We used to have 8,000 Christians in Gaza. Now there are 800 only. Many of them left. Many of the talented people have left Gaza. Gaza, they are very intellectually, they are very angry because they are punished for something that they didn't do. And this is what makes people are very angry in Gaza. And people are punished for something that they didn't know about when it will be released. They are in between Hamas in Gaza and between Israel. And the Israeli police towards Gaza has done the other side. For example, Gaza is more radical than before. As I tackled in many articles, Gaza, Hamas become powerful than before. The rocket range in Gaza, the range of the rocket in of Hamas in Gaza in 2001 was 8 kilometers. In 2009, it becomes 20. 2012, it becomes 40. 2014 war, it reached up to 80. So everybody.
Thank you, Jihad. Omar, we have you back. I think we have a better connection. If you could go back to the question that we asked, that Khaled asked you originally, that would be great. And I actually wanted to add to that question, if you can also, and you were going there a little bit, talk a little bit about the political realities in Gaza today, which is Hamas, how it is in leadership and how it, the nature of its rule, its control there. And the relationship a little bit between Hamas and the PA in Ramallah, I think would be interesting as well.
In a brief, there are five changes, psychological changes, intellectual changes. Gaza become less tolerant than before. Gaza become more radical. So we talk about 5,000 newborn every year, every month, 60,000 newborn every year. There are 700,000 people were born in the past 14 years. And there are another 700,000 people become adult in these 14 years. Two-thirds of the Gaza youth, who are 62% of the Gaza population, have never been outside. They become narrow-minded. It was easy 20 years ago to see Israeli Jewish coming to Gaza, going around eating fish in the very nice restaurant in Gaza. Now it becomes very difficult for me to speak about peace, possibility peace with the Israeli. Peace is not anymore in the mind of the people. 20 years ago, we used to export the flour, carnation, chocolate, garment, good things to Israel and to Europe. Now we export radicals to Sinai and to Iraq and to Syria. For me, as a secular person, I'm 58 years old. I love Gaza. I want to stay in Gaza. I want to make a change. It becomes very difficult because the space is shrinking. And we found ourselves in the middle of a battle that we have no stake on that. We did not make anything. I don't want here to please the Israeli, but the Israeli police towards Gaza is not good, not only for us, but also for them. We are neighbors. We are 10 kilometers far away from Ashkelon. We see the light of Ashkelon 24 hours. We don't have electricity. We have electricity 8 hours a day. We have no good water. We have no enough school. There is no good education. People cannot travel outside. Only 1,000, not in the corona. Before the corona, only 1,000 people, a daily average, who are able to exit Israel. 1,000 out of 2 million people with very special circumstances, coordination from Gisha and other Palestinian-Israeli organizations. Some students have been able to get to the Jordan directly. Not in the personal level. My son is in France for 10 years. I could not bring him in again. because it's very difficult for him to come to through Jordan areas to Gaza or from Egypt. So where we are heading? We are heading from bad to worse. It's a process of de-development. The GDP per capita in Gaza 20 years ago was one of the best in the Middle East. Gaza is known as entrepreneurial society. They put them themselves. There is a lot of civil society who's 100 years old. They are doing very good businesses. They used to export garments to Israel and to Europe to Marks and Spencer. We used to export carnation to Europe and some others to America itself, to the US, from Gaza. But now we are starving and we need money and we need food from everywhere. This is why Gaza become a place for all countries. It's easy, as just to summarize, to close this, the average salary for Gaza 20 years ago was $30 per day. So if you want to recruit a youth, you have to have pay him or her $1,000 a month. Now, by $100, by $200, somebody in Iraq, somebody in Syria, somebody in Sinai can recruit one or two young people in Gaza doing something against us and against the Israeli. It's very bad for us, and the Israeli should be aware that we are here, and Gaza will be 5 million people in 20 years' time. And there is no space. And there is no option. There are 20,000 fresh graduates in Gaza every year. 20,000. 1,000 is recruited by the government, another 2,000 by the private sector, which is also suffering. Where the destination of the other 16,000? We need to ask and we need to do a research about where are the destination. This is why in the siege, Gaza become very poorer, up to that other country become able to intervene. Last month, Gaza celebrated the anniversary of the assassination of Soleimani, as if we are part of Iran. This is very strange to us, because somebody wants to use Gaza suffering for a political reason. And there are many occasions where there was confrontation with Israel. I don't want to say Israel is doing a good job. Of course not. Israel, the primary reason for what we are suffering. But the consequences of the Israeli policy made it easy for others to play with our destiny, with our reality. Many countries in the region, Saudi, Qatar, Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, Iran, are competing in Gaza, are using us as a battlefield for their policy. The Hamas become stronger than before, and you can go back to the war 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014, and the other smaller confrontation. We call them one day war, or 2 days war, or 2 hours war. And I left all these wars. And my family and my two sons, they lived 2 wars of this. And can you imagine the young people who have never been outside, they only experience the bad things. So they don't speak about peace. And we are the Israeli policy of siege, they are graduating radical every day. As I said, it's not good for us. And Israel should ask themselves, what is the objective? The objective has said by the prime minister that we need to keep the Palestinian divide. Okay, as I said all the time, this is tactically good for Israel, but strategically, okay, they can keep the divide for another 10 years. But then what? Gaza, you will find a 3 million Palestinian who have collective depression. As I said, community depression, the whole society is under depression. I used to travel myself, so I am in good shape a little bit. But what about the other 2/3 of the society? Egypt, of course, has relation with Israel. Egypt does not recognize Hamas. It's part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Egypt in the dilemma between opening the Rafah crossing, which is the only crossing for 95% of the Gazan, and making relation with Hamas. So they have this checks and balance from time to time. Sometimes they have to talk to Hamas because they want assistance of Hamas in fighting the terrorism in Sinai, and sometimes they want to punish Hamas if Hamas does not do well here and there. So the relationship is not sustainable and is not based on in an objective way. It's very moody between the two countries. Rafah crossing, which is the only main crossing for the majority of the Gaza, was open for the past couple of weeks, 3 weeks, because Egypt wants to encourage the political faction to go for the election. But this crossing might be closed tomorrow or in 2 weeks. And there are so many thousands of Palestinians who want to leave, and thousands of Palestinians in the Gulf who want to come back to their family in Gaza. And this is not good for our economy, because there are so many thousands of Palestinian families who work in the Gulf or outside. When they come to Gaza, they revive the economy. So it's not only Hamas who's punished, but the majority or the whole society. If you ask the last question about BA and Hamas, Hamas is in control in Gaza, BA in control in Ramallah. There is a lot of tension. There is a lot of competition between the two. And the only two sectors that there are some sort of coordination is the health, or first the education and the health. And there is no strategic cooperation between the two, because they don't want, each one want to see or to show our the people in Gaza that they are the one who making good for them and the other one who making bad for them. And as I said, I described this policy is both of them, they are fighting over our bodies. BA has taken some measures against Gaza in terms of electricity, in terms of water, discounting the salary of the BA people in Gaza who were asked to sit at home. There are around 35,000 Palestinian public servants who used to work with the Palestinian Authority in Gaza. When Hamas took over in 14th of June 2007, the PA asked them to sit at home. So they have been paid for the past 14 years without doing anything. And this is a big problem also, social, psychological, intellectual, for those who didn't do anything. We hope, Palestinians in Gaza are very excited about election, 22nd of May. The registration on the election in Gaza has reached 100%. All the Gazans will vote, because the Gazans want to get rid of the situation. And I can say to you, Palestinians in Gaza, they know whom to drop. They know whom to fail. But unfortunately, till now, they don't know whom to succeed. And this is also another article that I'm thinking to write about it. They know who is to blame for the problem, but there is no emerging forces who can replace the traditional political system in Palestine, especially in Gaza. Freedom of expression in Gaza is under control. There are so many people were arrested, but the situation in West Bank is not always good. And I cannot talk myself everything on this public event, but I hope it was useful. Thank you again.
Okay. Jihad, given the difficulties of life in Gaza, we saw in recent years the emergence of this protest movement called the Great March of Return about 3 years ago when it first began, in which thousands of people would converge on the fence separating the Gaza Strip from Israel for these weekly protests. Since then, we've seen at least 214 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli army, including around 46 children, and more than 36,000 injured, including almost 9,000 children, by snipers and other military activities by the Israeli army. What happened? Well, first of all, what were the main demands of this protest movement? Who was behind them? And what happened to them?
The Great March of Return, which unfolded in March of 2018, was a catalyst, a moment that in which people's anger and frustration and despair has exploded in the form of a protest movement that would take various shapes, various forms, and would take multiple routes. Some were unfortunate, and some led to extreme bloodshed, loss of life, and led to a reality where now on the streets of Gaza, a common scene has become one where you can see young people, children, walking without their arms or without their legs, on crutches by the dozens. And of course, you know, protest movements are not something new to Palestinian politics or to Palestinian history. Protest movements start as a result of the accumulation of factors that has to do with the continued oppression of Palestinians, the denial of rights, and the structural conditions that create discrimination and deny people access not only to freedom of movement or to basic needs, but also to their basic rights. We're talking about water, electricity, travel, medical treatment, and so on and so forth. So the year 2017 witnessed a number of developments that would push Palestinians in Gaza and elsewhere to try to figure out ways to express their frustration. In December 2017, Trump announced that quote-unquote Jerusalem would be Israel's capital. 2 weeks later, the United States, the former United States administration, slashed funding to UNRWA. And in the course of a very short time, Palestinians saw a great deviation by the United States from its long-held policies towards issues like Jerusalem or refugees. And those issues combined are very dear to Palestinians, especially the refugee issue and Jerusalem issue. That led Palestinians in Gaza on a grassroots level in the civil society to think of organizing a protest movement that would address that they would use as a vehicle to express their frustration with these recent developments, demand an end for the blockade, but also shed light on the roots of why the Gaza Strip has been in turmoil for over 70 years. And that's why the March of Return was called the March of Return and wasn't called the March to End the Blockade, because people know that at the core of the tragedy in Gaza is the refugee crisis that hasn't been resolved since 1948, and that the Gaza Strip is suffering not only because there's a 15-year-old blockade, but also because unresolved big political questions that the current political frameworks have failed to achieve that. Now, of course, like any other protest movement, the March of Return was co-opted partly by some Palestinian factions on the ground, like Hamas. They tried to use the march and its unfolding to achieve short-term political gains, to bargain with the Israelis through the Egyptians, and so on and so forth. And of course, at the end of the day, the protest movement ended up, which started with a vision of peacefully gathering on the Palestinian side of the fence to express all these political demands, it ended up becoming trapped in a cycle of bloodshed, because on day one of the march, Palestinians lost more than 15 people and more than 1,500 were injured. And that were just the first few hours of the march. And that set the stage, the very brutal Israeli response from the first moment set the stage for turning the march into this bloody event that unfortunately ended up hurting Palestinians and creating a sense of disillusionment that a form of nonviolent protest movement gathering would not lead to neither an international response, an outcry, or even action on the part of the international community, nor will it shake Israeli politics and society and create any form of changes. So it left Palestinians in Gaza disillusioned and promoted the vision of the current forces there that their path is the path, instead of creating openings for young people or the civil society to organize in itself.
That's very useful. Thank you so much. Tanya, I want to come back to you and talk a little bit about the wars. And both Omar and Jihad have talked about this in the context of their answers. We have seen numerous wars in Gaza, 2009, 2012, 2014, kids who've experienced, this is the repeated defining experience of their lives. And other outbreaks of fighting, most recently in August 2020, thousands of deaths, tens of thousands injured, mostly Palestinian civilians, and of course, widespread destruction in Gaza over and over and over. Talk about the causes of these wars. Why do they keep recurring? And each time they end, based on some sort of agreement that's in theory supposed to put in place new dynamics, and then they happen again. Talk about those dynamics, and you know, if for people listening on the Hill, you know, what happened? What could be done to prevent this dynamic from recurring?
So, I mean, I think that there are, of course, multiple reasons for what's going on. But I would say on the broader picture, I connect very much with what Jihad and also Omar talked about. I mean, that the situation in Gaza can't be disconnected from 48. It can't be disconnected from what's happening in the West Bank and the kind of broader question of the conflict. It's not just that Israel is locked in a battle with Hamas, and if Hamas disappears, then everything will be solved. So I do think that that's the first thing to kind of keep in mind. There is a political problem in the region, and it requires a political solution. Whatever you think might be that solution is up to you. But I mean, something needs to happen on a fundamental level to transform the reality here. I don't think that there are kind of tactical answers. In the kind of, since 2008, 2009, like you said, Lara, there has been this kind of pattern set where after the war is fought, there's a period of kind of negotiations on a ceasefire. And then the parties kind of take out their like arsenal of, I always think of it as like this like poker game with a lot of chips. I don't know why. But, you know, the idea of kind of what are we trading in now? What will we give you to lead to another ceasefire? And in my mind, you know, that idea of violence leads to certain rewards or certain changes in the status of the Gaza Strip, or it can be over the fishing zone. It can be certain concessions regarding cash that came in through Qatar, for example. That to me has sent a message back that violence is something that leads to change, that leads to transformation. Instead of, you know, Israel seeing fundamentally an obligation to residents of Gaza, seeing their well-being, seeing stability, and well-being as kind of inherent to something that they should be promoting, they're now locked in this kind of relationship with Hamas and certainly also with the other factions of kind of outbreaks of violence and the negotiations that follow them. So that's another thing that I think is driving this kind of conflict on the localized level between Israel and Gaza. I would say another major reason is because we don't view Palestinian security the same way that we view Israeli security, certainly in Israel, but I would say also in the United States. This kind of idea of Israel's security being sacrosanct is very beneficial for me. I live in Israel. It's very nice. It's quiet in Tel Aviv. In Gaza, it's never quiet. And that's something that we hear a lot in the Israeli discourse of, you know, quiet for quiet. We'll stop fighting if they stop fighting. But actually, in between the escalations and conflict that you might read about in Washington, D.C., you have low-level violence on a day-to-day basis in Gaza, whether it's actual violence or kind of the bureaucratic violence that we're confronting in our work. Like I said, things like herbicide spraying, firing on fishermen who were crossing a demarcation in the sea. This kind of these actions vis-a-vis Gaza all of the time. And I think that without prioritizing Palestinian security, we're going to continue to see these escalations in violence, because it's not just these sporadic escalations that are appearing out of nowhere. They're happening in a larger context. And connected to that, I would say something that can be done to prevent future outbreaks is accountability. It's demanding accountability for the way that civilians are experiencing day-to-day life, but certainly also the escalations themselves. It's demanding accountability for violations of international law that are happening, not just by Hamas, which certainly does violate international law in its firing of rockets, but also by Israeli forces, in the escalations and also in the day-to-day life. I don't think that we're going to see a fundamental transformation in the situation here until we recognize the need for Palestinian security, for Palestinian dignity. And like Omar is saying, for the young people of Gaza, 70% of the population under 30, if they don't feel hope for the future, then I don't think, you need to be some kind of fortune teller or, great analyst to realize that people in Israel, and certainly in southern Israel, are also not going to have quiet and peace. And that's not a threat. That's simply a read of every place in the world where young people don't feel hope, where they don't have jobs. You're going to see instability. And that's where we are. Like I said, Israeli leaders, unfortunately, see Gaza as a situation to be managed. And I think there's certainly a lot of hubris, like Omar alluded to, this kind of tactical approach of we can manage this. We can mow the lawn every few years. We can close and open. We can keep the pot of water very, very hot without it boiling, I think is a lot of hubris. I think it's morally corrupt, certainly. And I think also just one last point, and that's that it connects to, I would say, a more strategic goal that Israel has, and that's to maintain control of the West Bank. The majority of the Israeli government, I certainly don't think that this is necessarily a position that has been in place forever, and certainly it could change, but the majority of the ruling coalition wants to maintain control of the West Bank. They see this region as Israel and the West Bank is one entity and Gaza is something separate. And in order to maintain that divide, they are happy for Hamas to stay in power. They're happy even to support some of these projects, gas for Gaza, maybe even building a port. That's not because they are great humanitarians and they want people in Gaza to be more prosperous. It's because it matches their vision for keeping Gaza separate and maintaining control of the West Bank. So I think to fundamentally shift and attain a real and sustainable solution, we also need to talk about reconnecting Gaza to the West Bank and also to Israel.
Thank you, Tanya. And you've, I think, addressed a lot of questions that people in Congress probably have based on what they're hearing every day, who's really responsible and who's doing what. I want to come back to the question of elections. You talked about looking forward to elections. The Palestinians in Gaza are looking forward to elections. Some in the U.S. and in Israel are already calling for Hamas to not be permitted to stand in elections. Obviously, Hamas is a designated terrorist organization under U.S. law, under Israeli law. Talk about the challenge that this poses. Is it possible to have legitimate elections that will be seen as legitimate by Palestinians if they don't include Hamas? And if they are going to include Hamas, what are your thoughts on how the international community should deal with that? We saw what happened in the last PLC elections, where Hamas participated as the Party of Change and Reform and ended up winning. And it basically opened the era we're in today with the international community, Israel and the U.S. saying we reject the results of a free and fair election, and we actually will punish the people for having voted wrong. So can you talk about how that is going to play out?
First of all, I think it's good for us, for our political system, to include Hamas in the election. It should not be left out. Otherwise, there will be in the corner, and they will destabilize the situation. The question is that whether we should ask a party to recognize Israel or to abide with the international law. I think the government should do that. And the international community has asked the Hamas-led government, which was formulated in March after the election 2006, to recognize the three conditions Hamas-led government didn't do. We hope this time there will be a coalition government led by the PA, the Palestinian Authority, where some of Hamas or second line of Hamas, this is what they are talking now, could be part of the government. We want Hamas to be part of the political system. It's an educational process. It's a process where they can be part of a legitimate process. It might take a couple of years. The international community should help the Palestinian to reform our political system. I don't want to go into details, but Hamas and Fatah are not political party. They are political movement. Their legitimacy based in history. They are not registered in the Ministry of Interior. So we have to do something at our home. We need to issue, President Abbas need to issue the law how to formulate a political party. There is a debate within Hamas that Hamas need to distinguish between ideology and political party, like the case in Tunisia or in Turkey. There is a debate within the movement. It sometimes gets up, sometimes goes down. We need to help. Myself in Gaza, I believe that we can influence what's going in Hamas. Hamas is not anymore a secretive movement. They have election within the leadership that started last Friday, 19th of February. Hamas is like the iceberg. It's not like 20 years ago that everything was very, very secret. Now we know a little bit about what's going on. There is a competition between the politician and the military. And we, the environment, the context of the Gaza Strip can influence what's going inside the movement because they are in the government. Hamas has 40,000 public servants in Gaza. Hamas has learned how to govern. Of course, they need to do something to meet the international community. It's not an easy question. The main principle that I can call that Palestinian people themselves should not be punished by the political purposes. If the international community want to boycott Hamas, maybe we don't like this, but we should not be punished by something that we are not part of it. It's a process that we need to be involved as civil society, as a Palestinian authority, as a political movement, as political analyst. We should start a process. And this is what all the time I keep saying. We should start a process where the Palestinian political system should transfer into more legitimate. It's not, by the way, it's not the problem with Hamas. There are other 14 political factions. Some of them, they have military wing. Also like Hamas, we have the BFLB, we have the DLFP, and there are so many other military groups who emerged in the past 14 years that they don't recognize Israel and they don't want peace because they are affiliated with other groups outside in the region. And as I said at the beginning, the Israeli siege has given Gaza easily to the hand of others. So Gaza become a platform or a kitchen where everybody is cooking in our kitchen apart from us. We are not in the radar. We don't influence the situation. And because we are punished by the Israeli policy, we are punished by the position of the international community. It's not easy thing, but we need to think together how we get rid of out. Hamas is not going to leave. They cannot disappear. They are 20% of the society. It's possibly that Hamas, when they go to election on 22nd of May, they might get 30 to 40 seats. They will not get the majority according to different polls. I think some of them, they don't want to get the majority. They don't want to lead the government. They want to be part of the political system. And there is a debate, strong debate within the movement between the politicians, between those who believe that they need to be part of the legitimacy and those who think that Gaza is the end of the story. And Gaza is too small. Gaza 362 kilometers square. But many people who didn't leave Gaza, they think Gaza is too big, like Texas. They don't know that Gaza is like a district in Washington. It's too small to be a state or to be a country. But how you expect people who have never been outside to think about the whole world? It's our interest, it's Israel's interest, it's the stability for the Middle East to open Gaza, to open the mind of the people, to get them socialized and contact with outsiders.
We have to end it there. You've been listening to a forum focused on Gaza, which was produced by the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound editor, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
شغفا قبلا